Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Poole, and my guest today is my friend Steve Greenfield. And we're going to talk about Democratic progressives and Joe Biden. So, Steve, what's your thoughts for today?
Okay, well, you know, obviously, since we set up this phone call, there's been a pretty major change in what's happening with Joe Biden and the whole idea of blue no matter who, and whether that's really going to fly come November, Trump's complete mangling of the COVID-19 response and inability to string an English sentence together in front of a microphone, notwithstanding. The Democrats and the Biden campaign are now suddenly facing a new burden as of yesterday. They'd been all issuing blanket denials, not Biden himself, because he won't personally speak to the issue, but a bunch of proxies and campaign officials have been issuing blanket denials about the possibility that anything related to Tara Reid's complaint about sex abuse back in the 1990s.
Right.
is worth any kind of comment at all, which was a strange approach to take in the first place, given how many women have been saying that they absolutely will not vote for Biden. And it's not only a function of the Tara Reid complaint, which, you know, is actually at the moment, you know, still like not factually concluded as a known thing, but there are all those videos. And there was the Flores complaint and a number of other very credible complaints from seven other women about specific actions that Biden did not deny. He responded to them only by saying, I guess I have to pay more attention to being in people's space from now on. And with, mm-hmm. you know, so many women posting, you know, on social media that, you know, they never Biden, that they will not vote for Biden. The choice to not respond to the Tara Reid allegation was always struck me as a questionable tactic. But now there are people that did know her in the 1990s that are corroborating that she definitely told them, you know, and one of those corroborators actually giving pretty substantial detail about what she was told. And other elements of her story being corroborated, like people who worked under her at Joe Biden's office at that time, have confirmed that she suddenly departed as their supervisor, you know, which conforms to what she said, and a few other things. So now they've got a really big problem, you know, on their hands. You know, why they thought the media would unite like CNN has done behind not investigating these claims like the way they did and try to turn it into a culture war where Fox News is claiming it's a conspiracy of silence and the Democrats are saying, you know, we've got enough proof that it didn't happen and just turning it into one of those culture war things. This was really an odd moment in American cultural history in the face of the way the Democrats tried to take ownership of the Me Too movement. From the moment it was out of the gate for them to take that particular approach. But now there's a whole problem, right? Now the missing corroboration is coming in. It's got names on it, actual people. It's not, you know, an anonymous source who spoke on the condition of not being named. It's real people. So they've got a brand new situation added on top of the existing situations, which were the policy problems that you know, slammed the door once again on every progressive goal and raised the standard question of if the progressive vote has not been reliable on a lesser evil basis so consistently, why would anyone think that this election would be different? Why would anyone think that this shouldn't be an election where at least one significant plank is given back to the progressives as an invitation? You know, I don't care whether it's tuition-free college. Obviously, with the medical crisis we're in, the obvious choice is, you know, single-payer and sick leave, right, so that nobody has to worry that they're losing their families and their homes and their ability to eat because of medical mm-hmm. bills, right? So single payer would be the obvious one to give back right now, and I think most of the people who object to it would, drop their objection in the face of the pandemic, and then let it play out in the legislative process after the election. But why, this is kind of, besides the Tara Reid thing, which just came up yesterday, this is why we came to talk on this particular phone call today, which is trying to figure out how, there's two sides to this coin, right? Why does the corporate dominant element of the Democratic Party seem to think that they can just keep on with the pattern of never offering any inducement to progressives in the form of a policy or two to get progressives to vote if the only thing that matters is winning, as everyone keeps saying, if the only thing that matters is beating Trump, then why not use every tool in the toolbox to make sure you get enough votes? If people are blue no matter who, you're not going to lose any of them if you offer student debt relief or tuition-free public college. Not a single person is going to go, oh, I think I'll just let Trump become president now that they're offering tuition-free public college. Like, that's just not going to happen, and we all know that. But offering it would very well relieve concerns of some people who don't want to vote for another pro-banking corporatist to say, all right, he's throwing me a bone. This is important to me. This is something we can actually get if he wins. And even though I don't like his positions on a lot of other issues, he's extending me an invitation, and I'm going to accept it, right? Why would the Democrats not be attempting that if the only thing that matters is winning this election? Winning means you get every single vote you can get, right? Affirmatively, not by default because the other guy's worse. Winning means you act affirmatively to pursue every single vote you can get. Now, on the other side of that coin is, why are progressives, again, doing almost nothing to place a demand on this candidate, and not just Biden, but all the congressional candidates, all but four of whom are not progressive, all but four of the 435 Democrats running for Congress this year. Not four. There's a couple that are halfway. Let's double that number. Let's say there are eight, that are progressive out of 435. Plus Biden, of course, which is and all the talk of Biden picking a vice presidential candidate is focused around Stacey Abrams, who's from Henry Kissinger's foreign policy think tank and does not support single payer and does not support any of the progressive goals. She does not support a Green New Deal. So again, why is all the talk focused on Stacey Abrams as a running mate and going for an identity coalition instead of trying to pursue an ideological coalition? Because there are at least eight black female members of the House of Representatives right now who support the progressive agenda. And some of them are from purple states, which means that naming them could actually help, right? Georgia is not going to go Democrat if Biden nominates Stacey Abrams. That's a Trump state no matter what, And even the handful of people that are talking about Kamala Harris, who is also very right-wing, California is going to be blue, period. Like, neither one of these right-wing candidates add a significant electoral piece to the puzzle. And they only conform to the right-wing ideology that Biden holds himself. Talk of could it be Elizabeth Warren makes a lot more sense, because at least Warren was very good on banking and debt, and those issues. But no, the right-wing is playing the race card to say it can't just be a woman. It has to be a black woman, and it has to be one of two specific black women who happen to be the pro-banking black women. It's actually pretty hard to find a pro-banking black woman in politics today. But true to their colors, the Dems have figured out a way to find the two whose names people recognize and force the conversation to be solely around those two. So here's the story. Here's the part that I need to ask about progressives, which is, why do progressives always fall into the same trap of believing this is not the time to put pressure on the nominee? That is the most self-defeating and the most election-losing practice that could be done no matter where you are on the ideological spectrum. This is not just a problem of progressives. It would be a problem for anybody. But the difference for progressives is that progressives are the only people that actually don't apply any pressure. You know, your right-wing groups are applying pressure. They'll tell you, you know, back in, you know, during the blue no matter who thing, during the primaries, when people said, I don't think I'll vote for the Democrats if they nominate Bernie Sanders because he's just too left-wing for me, nobody accused them of doing something terrible. You know, that was only held for Sanders supporters who said, I might not vote for Biden. And the progressives just sort of passively accept always being in that position. When someone is deciding what their platform is going to look like, they decide that on the basis of what they think it's going to do to their vote totals. If you are believing in a certain policy or set of policies, and you make clear to that candidate that your vote is not in any way dependent on any of those policies being addressed, the candidate is going to take that at face value, right? That's good. That goes right in the vote ledger. These people are voting for me. I don't have to strategize anything for them. They've made their commitment. Then you've got people on the right who are applying pressure. The lobbyists are coming in and say, we need this, we need this, we need this. And, you know, we have other right-wing candidates available. We can vote for Trump. We can stay home, whatever. The candidate then looks at that and says, oh, those votes are not assured. I need to design my platform towards them. And that's why we're drifting to the right, drifting to the right, drifting to the right, drifting to the right, drifting to the right. There are a lot of people of progressive intent in this country, but they never make a demand, even though they will all put on their social media, you know, a meme of Frederick Douglass famously saying back in the 1850s that power concedes nothing without a demand, and it never has and it never will, right? We all have that slogan memorized. We put Frederick Douglass up on our Facebook pages, you know, with that quote on it, and yet the progressives never make a demand. The progressives just go, well, I don't want to be the person who got in the way of things becoming even, you know, potentially becoming even worse. And the right-wing people and the corporate people, they always make demands. You know, that's how Joe Biden and Bill Clinton ended up passing the crime bill in the first place. People were screaming that they wanted harsher punishments, that they wanted more arrests for lower-level crimes and harsher punishments, because there was a lot of advertising being done in the 80s and 90s around that theme, and there had been a crack epidemic and all kinds of things that were driving people into a froth about harsher criminal justice. And so the Democrats themselves, the Democrats, not the Republicans, the Democrats jumped right into it, federalized all kinds of crimes, you know, built for-profit prisons, started this whole prison industrial complex system that is now a lobby that protects its own financial interests, put millions of black and brown people in jail for nonviolent, you know, drug offenses, ruined communities, everything about it. Why? Because the people that wanted that done were making it clear that their vote depended on that being done. And here we are in the year 2020, and progressives and social justice advocates are not making clear to the man who wrote the crime bill that their vote depends on his commitment to repeal it. Like, I don't get that. I don't get that. And people keep saying, oh, it's not the time now. It's not the time. It's too dangerous. It's not the time now. Well, you know, when is the time? When somebody is trying to figure out how to put a lot of votes together, how to put together the broadest possible coalition of votes in order to win an election, what other time do you conceive of is the time to make your demand? Of course this is the time. This is always the time. It's the and in fact, it's more the time than ever, because if Donald Trump really is, you know, a potential Adolf Hitler, and nothing in the whole world matters more than getting rid of Donald Trump, then this is the perfect time, better than any previous Republican running for the office. to say, well, if you really need my vote, if it's that urgent that you have my vote, here's what you need to do to get it. And if the person who is telling you that nothing is more urgent than needing your vote doesn't respond, that means he was lying about nothing being more important than needing your vote. That means he was lying about that. You know, that's how you find out that they were lying. And so you put that pressure on and let the person know, yeah, the right wing, their vote might not be assured, but the left wing, our vote is also not assured. And your job as a candidate is to figure out how to balance that and get both sides of us to vote for you instead of putting everything on the scale on the right side because you're assuming that we're voting for you no matter what, no matter how right wing you get, no matter how many black people you put in prison, no matter how many banks you rescue and leave mortgage holders bankrupt, no matter how many of those things you do, we're going to vote for you no matter what. Of course, they're going to keep on doing it. And once they do it, it's now the law of the land. You're not going to get it undone. You're never going to get it undone. Once the train's left the station, it's left the station. And so progressives need to now stand firm and recognize that if the situation of the need to remove Trump is as desperate as everyone keeps saying that it is, that means that this election cycle, even more than any previous election cycle, is the moment when the demands need to be made and that it needs to be made clear that our votes are not assured and that they will be dependent upon something being tossed our way so that we know that a Biden presidency would at least in some respects be valuable to our goals.
So the establishment Democrats, they should have known that something like this was going to pop up, right?
Well, by this, do you mean progressive resistance or do you mean Tara Reid? Well, of course it should have been known that there was the potential for it because, you know, as what is his name? The guy from The Intercept who's been writing about Tara Reid, Ryan Grimm, as he said in an interview on The Rising yesterday, the statement that Biden campaign people have been made, and it's interesting because, of course, they're always having women be the spokesperson for this particular thing, is that they're bringing forth people who were part of the Biden Senate campaign staff in the 1990s, and they're having them all say that they never, you know, they never witnessed Joe Biden behaving inappropriately at work. And that's a ludicrous statement on the face of it. Because there are videos, you know, of all those swearing in, there are videos, you know, official news videos, not some conspiracy videos or some doctored videos. There are dozens of videos that are on YouTube that have been on the news of Joe Biden behaving extremely inappropriately at work. So the idea that there weren't other times when the cameras weren't rolling that people around him witnessed him behaving inappropriately at work is ludicrous on the face of it. You've got a giant credibility problem. You know, at least in 1992, you know, if you'll pardon, this was the Bill Clinton campaign's expression and not mine, so pardon the phrasing because that was their phrasing and not mine. But in 1992, Bill Clinton's campaign had something they called the Bimbo Patrol.
Right.
They had people whose job was to quickly move around the country and pay off anybody who was going to open their mouths about his sexual proclivities, about things they witnessed, right? I mean, we know that he did this with state troopers, you know, driving his cars and all. There were plenty of people who could open their mouths, and his campaign actually had a group that was empowered to find these people and pay them off so that they wouldn't talk at least until after the election, right? And James Carville was very big about that. And constantly, you know, made that infamous statement, you know, when questioned about Paula Jones, about how, you know, you never know what you're going to catch when you drag a $100 bill through a trailer park. I mean, my God, he was able to say something like that, and his candidate was still able to win the election. I mean, good Lord, just think about something like that. But at least back then, since this kind of thing has always been part of the culture of mainstream politics, of high-end politics, right? Sleeping with interns, whatever, right? This isn't news. It's a big, like, frat party down there, right? We all know that. So should they have known that this was going to be something with the potential, something to have a formal policy of how to address, because obviously trying to fly around and bribe people into silence is not going to fly in 2020, that they didn't specifically come up with a formal structural approach for how to be conciliatory, for how to acknowledge something, even if they want to claim, oh, it's from the past, he's learned, he's grown out of it. Isn't the idea of having a politician who can actually learn and change something that we value? Something, right? Something, anything. I can't say exactly what they should have done because I would never be in that position. I'm not somebody who's, you know, behaved inappropriately towards people in the course of my life, you know, and maybe that's why I'm not a successful politician. I have no idea. But so I don't know exactly what is the way to approach that without making a fool of yourself. But certainly, since many of these people have been with Joe Biden over the course of his entire career and saw what they saw, it involved so many people, they had to know. Yes, they were responsible to not only know, but to have a damage control response, hire some professional damage control psychologists and lawyers and spokespeople. You know, there are consulting agencies all over the country that get hired by corporations for, you know, for damage control management. You know, that's what they needed to do, because the idea that they were going to get all the way to November without those, you know, genuine cans of worms being found and opened is an impossible thing to imagine, that they thought, oh, it's going to be no big deal, or that they thought, oh, Donald Trump's still going to be worse. Everyone's still going to know that Donald Trump's even worse. So they're not going to make a big deal out of it. They had all contributed very heavily to the establishment of the supposed primacy of the Me Too movement, of labeling everyone who came forward to be a courageous victim and to be believed on the face of their complaint and what courage they have. And also they even built the response to the age-old question of why do so many women seem to wait so long before they come out with what happened to them. Mm-hmm. They worked on all that. And so they had to know that they had built this very top-heavy ideological support for the women who complain, and to think that they didn't need to be prepared with this particular candidate. Again, it's all about this particular candidate. You know, did they need to have this response ready for Mayor Pete or Kamala Harris or Amy Klobuchar or, you know, probably not. You know, obviously Bernie mm-hmm. Sanders. Bernie Sanders is even older than Joe Biden and somehow made it through a political career. He became a mayor in 1983, and he was in Congress starting in 1993, and has made it to this ripe old age without a single observation or complaint about inappropriate behavior in his entire life. So obviously, it's possible to have a mainstream and highly successful career in politics without having this incorporated into your daily routine. But in the case of this particular candidate that they had promoted as the front runner since a year ago today, when he first announced that he'd be entering and entered as the quote-unquote front runner, somehow the media already had that determined, they had to know that this was a candidate with an enormous amount of baggage. Even left-wing comedy shows like Jon Stewart, you know, and Samantha Bee had done bits about it going all the way back to 2015, you know. They had to know that this was a looming issue with this candidate, and they made a strategic decision to just go with the shrug of the shoulders and, hey, Trump's worse, and think that the Me Too women were not going to stick with their principles, and the men who support women, men like me, who say, how dare you ask me to promote a manager who was abusive to women, who was sexually inappropriate towards women, and to commit myself to promoting that person to the highest office in the land, instead of sticking with what we said we were going to do, which was to change the culture by not rewarding those people, by ending the reward system, by ending the impunity that your ambitions cannot be interfered with in any way if you are one of the people that just routinely does this to women. We all said we'd stop doing that, and now we're being told, no, we have to do it, and not just to be like, moving up from office manager to one of the lower vice presidencies in a corporation. No, we're asking you to make this person, the president of the United States, the ultimate form of validation. How did they ever conceive that there wouldn't be some people who like were on the women's marches and devoted themselves to Me Too and the courage of women coming forward and the theory of why so many times it takes years before people come forward, to think that this would not weigh on their candidate? That's their shortcoming. And if Trump wins this election, despite his mangling of the COVID-19 response, if he wins this election anyway, it's not just going to be because of Joe Biden. It's going to be because of all the people in the Democratic Party, the financial support systems, the lobbyists, everyone who decided a year ago that Joe Biden was going to have to be the Democratic Party nominee, that they picked the most at-risk candidate for the contemporary liberal philosophy, that they actually selected the most at-risk candidate in the entire country to be the one that they ordained as the nominee, and then followed through and did that. Why, again, like with Hillary Clinton, who had so much baggage of her own and was so hawkish and pro-war and so pro-banking, that they made this decision and thought that they had calculated the risk. You know, a little bit of that is on us as progressives, as we were talking about before, because we don't make it clear verbally that our votes are going to depend on it. Obviously, in 2016, we saw at the voting booths that quite a few of us, had made our votes dependent on our policies being addressed. And not just progressives, but also, a 1.5 million black people disappeared, and almost all of them were in the swing states, and let Latin American people also disappeared from the voting booths that had voted so strongly for Obama and then just stayed home in 2016. I think if those stay-at-home people had made it clear during the campaign that their vote is in doubt, that Hillary Clinton might have, done a little bit of tinkering with her platform or her public statements so as not to lose those votes. And she lost them because people never verbalized that their votes were at risk. And so that's why it's even more important that we do it now, that we verbalize it very strongly, line in the sand. Our votes are not assured to you. You need to do something.
Well, Steve, our time is up now. So you're running for Congress, and tell people a little bit about your campaign.
Sure. Come to the website stevegreenfieldforcongress.com or my Facebook page, Steve Greenfield for Congress, New York 19. You can find me on Facebook very easily and on my website. I am running on the Green Party line. I am running against one of these right-wing, heavily corporatist, Wall Street finance Democrats who is against single payer, who is against the Green New Deal, who is against making universal health care available, even in the midst of this pandemic, who is pro-war, who found money to finance Trump's Space Force, but wouldn't vote for money to relieve student loan debt. Everything that we always talk about, you know, the crises that we're in, and so I am in this race basically as a response to the failure of both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party to not only address the basic ongoing functional needs of administering a functioning civil society, but certainly now is as plainly visible as ever could have been in history, that they did not build any resilience into our system, that they did not build the capacity to survive a crisis into our system, just as so many average people were never paid enough money to build themselves enough savings account to survive 2 weeks without a job, that the entire nation was put in that position by Democrats and Republicans collaborating with Wall Street and the war machine. And we absolutely have to stop voting for Republicans and Democrats. People stay home. More than 50% of people stay home. So they already know that they're not voting, and they already know why. And the number of people that don't vote, double the number of people that vote for either party. And so the goal this year is to, you know, follow up on the very clear visibility, you know, that what we've been talking about for years, which is that voting for Democrats and Republicans does not work. It's a failure. It was a house of cards. It's now collapsed. Now everyone can see it. And so I truly believe that this is the year that a lot of those non-voters will come out, because the reason they haven't been voting has come to pass. And I think a lot of people who have been voting for traditional parties will also recognize that they need to be a new path forward and not a return to normality, because normality is how we got here. And so come to SteveGreenfieldForCongress.com, make a donation, send me an email. I answer all messages personally.
And I also invite Antonio Delgado to come on the show and present his side of the story. So you have been listening to All Exits Close with Steve Greenfield. If you like this show, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, All Exits Close. Steve, thank you, and we will talk again. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you.